A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's running into the classic consultant's tangle around client expenses. The core question is how to handle spending money on behalf of clients without creating an accounting nightmare or legal exposure. He mentions preferring virtual payment cards when clients issue them, but recounts one situation where a high net worth client wanted him to hold cash on trust, and, when he refused, they handed him a credit card instead and buried him in administrative work, filing every expense down to $5 charges. The heart of it is this tension. You want to make life easy for clients, but saying yes without thinking through the consequences can cost you time, money, and legal exposure. And the right answer probably shifts depending on whether you're a sole operator or part of a larger practice.
This is one of those topics where the surface question is about payment methods, but the real thing underneath is about who carries the risk. And most of the advice out there is written for companies with finance departments. It completely misses what happens when you're one person, and the person who does the expenses is also the person who does the work and the person who does the taxes.
The finance department is me in a shoebox.
So let's start with the thing Daniel flagged as his preferred method, virtual payment cards. These are essentially card numbers generated for a specific purpose, often with spending limits, expiration dates, or merchant category restrictions built in. The client issues one, you use it for their expenses, the charges land on their statement, and you never touch the money.
The money never passes through your books. That's the magic.
That's the magic. And it's not some niche fintech experiment anymore. Brex, Stripe, Ramp, Airbase, all of them offer virtual card issuance now. Brex in particular built a whole business around this. Their virtual cards let you set per card spending limits, lock cards to specific vendors, set expiration dates that match a project timeline. The client's finance person can spin one up in 30 seconds and email you the card details.
This solves the taxable income problem straight away. Because if a client reimburses you for an expense, that reimbursement can look like income unless you're meticulous about documenting it as a pass-through. And if you mess that up, you're paying tax on money that was never yours.
The IRS is not messing around on this. Publication 535, which covers business expenses, is very clear. If you receive an advance or reimbursement from a client, you have to account for it properly or it gets treated as gross income. The virtual card approach sidesteps the whole thing because the funds never hit your account. You're not being reimbursed. You are never out of pocket.
The question becomes, why doesn't every client do this?
A few reasons. One, some companies just don't have the infrastructure. Virtual card issuance usually comes through a corporate card platform or a spend management tool. And if the client is running their business on a single Chase Sapphire card in QuickBooks, they might not have the option. Two, some finance teams are weirdly attached to reimbursement workflows because that's what they've always done. And three, and this is the one that I think matters most for the kind of clients Daniel's describing, high net worth individuals and family offices often operate differently from companies. They might not have a corporate card program. They might have a personal assistant who handles expenses manually. The virtual card solution assumes a certain level of organizational infrastructure.
The virtual card is the ideal. But it's not universally available, which means you need a decision framework for when it's not on the table. And that framework has to account for scale, sole operator versus practice with staff.
Let's build that framework. I think there are basically four models for handling client expenses, and each one has a different risk profile and a different administrative burden. Model 1 is the virtual card. Client pays directly, you never touch the money. Model 2 is the advance. Client sends you funds up front, you spend against that balance, and you reconcile at the end. Model 3 is reimbursement. You pay out of pocket and the client pays you back. Model 4 is the client-issued card. You carry a card in the client's name and use it for their expenses.
The situation Daniel described with the high net worth client was Model 4, with the added indignity of having to file every charge down to the $5 level.
And here's the thing about Model 4, it's Model 3 wearing a costume. It feels like Model 1 because you're swiping a card that isn't yours, but the administrative burden is actually worse than reimbursement because now you're doing the client's expense reporting for them. You're not just tracking what you spent, you're categorizing it, justifying it, attaching receipts, all according to their internal processes.
You've become their bookkeeper, unpaid.
If that card is in your name, even as an authorized user, and something goes wrong, you're in the chain of responsibility. If the card is in the client's name and you're just holding it, there can still be questions about who authorized which charge. I've seen situations where a consultant used a client's card for what they thought was an approved expense, and the client later disputed it.
Let's go through these models and figure out where the pitfalls actually are. Starting with the advance model, client sends you money, you spend it, you reconcile.
The accounting treatment is the first thing. If a client sends you $10,000 as an advance for expenses, that is not your money and it is not income, but your bank account doesn't know that. You need to track it as a client funds liability on your balance sheet, spend against it, keep every receipt, and then return any unspent balance. If you don't return the balance promptly, or if you commingle it with your operating funds, you're creating a mess. And in some jurisdictions, holding client funds can trigger trust accounting rules or even licensing requirements.
That was the thing Daniel flagged. The client who wanted him to hold cash on trust, and he refused.
Holding client funds in trust is not a casual arrangement. In the legal profession, trust accounting is heavily regulated. Lawyers have to keep separate trust accounts, they're audited, they can be disbarred for messing it up. Consultants aren't typically subject to those rules, but the underlying principle is the same. Once you're holding someone else's money, you have a fiduciary duty. If the bank fails, if there's fraud, if the IRS looks at that deposit and asks questions, it's on you.
The scale question matters here. A larger practice might have a dedicated client funds account and someone whose job includes reconciliation. A sole operator is doing all of this on a Sunday afternoon when they'd rather be doing literally anything else.
The advance model can work if the amounts are predictable and the timeline is short. If you're running a two-day workshop and the client sends you $500 for materials, fine. Spend it, send the receipts, return the $12 left over, done. But if it's an ongoing engagement with fluctuating expenses over months, the reconciliation burden compounds fast.
Model 3, reimbursement. You pay out of pocket, client pays you back. This is probably the most common arrangement in consulting.
The most dangerous from a tax perspective, because now you're commingling by design. Your money and the client's expenses are coming out of the same account. If you don't have a clean system for separating them, you're going to have a bad time at tax season. The IRS wants to see that reimbursements are not income. That means you need to track every expense, categorize it, match it to the corresponding reimbursement, and be able to produce that documentation if asked.
The reimbursement itself. If the client sends you a lump sum that covers both your fee and your expenses, and you don't break it out on the invoice, congratulations, you just made the entire amount taxable.
This is where I see sole operators make the same mistake over and over. They invoice for $10,000, $8,000 for the work, $2,000 for expenses, but they don't itemize it. The client pays $10,000. The IRS sees $10,000 in revenue, and now you're paying tax on $2,000 that just passed through you. The fix is simple. Itemize expenses on the invoice, keep receipts, and make sure your accounting system distinguishes between revenue and reimbursements. But simple doesn't mean people do it.
I've seen the opposite mistake too. People who deduct the expenses but forget to record the reimbursement as a reimbursement, so it sits in revenue and they're effectively double counting. The IRS does not love that either.
No, they do not. So reimbursement can work, but it requires discipline. And you need to be comfortable floating the expenses. If a client takes 60 days to pay and you've put $5,000 on your personal card, that's $5,000 of your working capital tied up.
Which brings us back to the virtual card as the gold standard. But you mentioned that not every client can issue them. So what do you do when the ideal isn't available and you're looking at models 2, 3, or 4?
I think the first thing is to recognize that this is a negotiation, not an accommodation. The way Daniel framed it, one wants to make life easy for clients. That instinct is good business, but it can lead you to absorb costs and risks that the client should be carrying. The client's expenses are the client's expenses. Your job is to spend them responsibly, not to finance them or administer them.
The phrase unjust accounting burden in the prompt is doing a lot of work. It's not just unjust in the sense of unfair. It's unjust in the sense that the burden properly belongs to the client's finance function, not to the consultant's. When you take it on, you're effectively providing free back office services.
Here's a concrete way to think about it. Suppose you're billing $200 an hour. If you spend 2 hours a month on expense reporting for a client, that's $400 of unbillable time, or $400 you could have billed to another client. Over a year, that's $4,800. Over a multi-year engagement, it's real money. And that's before we talk about the mental overhead of keeping track of receipts and categories and deadlines.
The cognitive load of being a part-time bookkeeper for someone else's business.
So the framework I'd propose is this. First, always start by requesting a virtual card. Explain why. It's cleaner for your accounting. It keeps their expenses off your books. It reduces everyone's liability. Many clients who could do it will do it once they understand the rationale. Second, if a virtual card isn't possible, propose an advance arrangement with clear terms. The advance covers estimated expenses for a defined period. You reconcile monthly unspent funds are returned or rolled forward with explicit agreement. Third, if the client insists on reimbursement, build the administrative cost into your rate or add an expense handling fee. This is not weird. Law firms do it. Consulting firms do it. A 5 or 10% surcharge on pass-through expenses is standard in many industries. It compensates you for the float, the tracking, and the tax compliance overhead.
Fourth, if the client wants you to carry their card, just say no. That's the one where the prompt's example is basically a cautionary tale. The $5 credit charges, the uncompensated time, the legal exposure, none of that is worth it.
I'd go further and say Model 4 should not exist in professional services. If a client hands you a credit card and asks you to manage their expense reporting, what they're really doing is outsourcing their internal controls to you without paying for it. And you're accepting liability for something you have no business accepting liability for. What happens if the card is compromised? What happens if there's a disputed charge 6 months later? What happens if the client decides an expense wasn't authorized after all?
The other thing that jumps out from the prompt is the scale question, whether the consultant is part of a practice or a sole operator. Let's talk about how the analysis changes.
In a larger practice, you have leverage. You can say our firm's policy is X and it carries weight. You probably have an engagement letter that spells out expense handling. You might have an accounting department that handles reconciliation. The administrative burden per consultant is lower because it's spread across multiple people and there are systems in place.
The engagement letter point is important. A sole operator can and should have an engagement letter too, but in practice, many don't. They have an email thread and a handshake, and then when the expense question comes up, there's nothing to point to.
The engagement letter should absolutely address expenses. It doesn't have to be complicated. Client will provide a virtual payment card for project-related expenses is one sentence. Consultant will invoice for reimbursable expenses monthly, with receipts attached and payment is due within 15 days is another. Expenses exceeding $500 require prior written approval is a third. Three sentences, and you've just prevented 90% of the problems we're talking about.
It's easier to have that conversation at the start than 6 months in when you're already frustrated about the $5 charges.
The other advantage a practice has is that they can afford to fire a client over this. A sole operator might feel they can't. If you're depending on one or two big clients for most of your revenue, the pressure to accommodate unreasonable requests is much higher. But that's exactly when the risks are highest, because a dispute with your biggest client over expenses can threaten your whole business.
The sole operator paradox is that you have less leverage and more exposure at the same time.
Which is why the framework has to be even more disciplined for sole operators. You can't afford to be casual about this. Every expense arrangement needs to be documented. Every reimbursement needs to be tracked. And you need to be willing to walk away from a client who won't respect reasonable boundaries. Because a client who won't give you a virtual card but will hand you their personal credit card and demand line item reporting is telling you something about how they'll treat you on everything else.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I was going to say it's a leading indicator of client dysfunction, but yes, also like adopting a feral cat.
Let's talk about some specific mechanics. When you do have to handle reimbursements, what does good practice look like?
Separate tracking is non-negotiable. Whether it's a dedicated credit card that you use only for client expenses, or a separate category in your accounting software, or even a spreadsheet if you're very small, you need to be able to produce a clean report of what you spent, when, for which client, with receipts. QuickBooks, Xero, FreshBooks, they all handle this. Even something like Expensify or a dedicated email folder for receipts is better than nothing.
The receipt threshold matters. The IRS requires receipts for expenses over $75, but for client reimbursements, you should keep everything. The client might want to see that $5 parking charge, and if you can't produce it, you eat it.
The other mechanical thing is timing. Reimbursable expenses should be invoiced monthly, not accumulated. The longer the gap between the expense and the invoice, the more likely something gets lost or disputed. And if a client is slow to pay reimbursements, you need to have a conversation about it, not just let the balance build up while you quietly resent them.
What about the advance model mechanics? If a client sends you money up front, how do you handle it properly?
Separate bank account if the amounts are significant. For most sole operators, a separate ledger account within your existing accounting system is probably sufficient, but the key is that you can point to exactly where the money is and what it's been spent on at any moment. You should also have a written agreement about what happens to unspent funds. Default assumption is they go back to the client, but some arrangements allow you to roll them forward to the next period. Whatever it is, write it down.
Never ever treat the advance as your money, even if it's sitting in your account. Even if the client says, just use it, however. The tax authority will not see it that way.
There's a specific IRS concept here called constructive receipt. If you have unrestricted access to funds, they may be considered income even if you haven't spent them. An advance that comes with no strings attached, no requirement to account for spending, no obligation to return unspent funds. That's not an advance, that's a payment. And it's taxable.
The strings are actually protective. The more formal the arrangement, the clearer it is that this is not your money.
Formality is your friend here. It feels bureaucratic and annoying, but it's what separates a legitimate expense arrangement from a tax problem.
Let's circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the idea of an expense handling fee. How does that work in practice?
There are a few ways to structure it. The simplest is a percentage markup on pass-through expenses. 5-15% is common depending on the industry and the volume. This compensates you for the administrative overhead, the float, and the compliance burden. Law firms have been doing this forever. It's called a service charge or administrative fee, and it's completely standard.
It's not hidden. It's in the engagement letter. It's on the invoice. The client knows about it up front.
Another approach is to build it into your rate. If you know a particular engagement is going to involve significant expense handling, you price that in. Your hourly rate or project fee reflects the additional non-billable time you'll spend on administration. The client doesn't see a separate line item, but you're still being compensated.
The third approach is to cap it. The first $500 of expenses per month carry no surcharge. Beyond that, a 10% handling fee applies. That protects you from the scenario where a project suddenly involves way more expenses than anyone anticipated.
It also incentivizes the client to issue a virtual card. If there's a 10% surcharge on reimbursed expenses, but no surcharge on virtual card expenses, suddenly the finance team has a reason to figure out how to issue one.
The handling fee is both compensation and a nudge toward better behavior.
Behavioral economics in the engagement letter.
I want to go back to the trust accounting question, because I think it's the scariest part of the prompt and the one that most consultants haven't thought about. Daniel mentioned a client asking him to hold cash on trust, and he refused. What would have happened if he'd said yes?
It depends on the jurisdiction and the amount, but the short answer is, he'd be taking on fiduciary obligations without necessarily knowing what they were. In the worst case, if something went wrong, if the funds were misappropriated, even accidentally, he could be personally liable. If the arrangement wasn't properly documented, the tax authority might treat the funds as income. If the client went bankrupt, the funds could get caught up in bankruptcy proceedings. And in some regulated professions, holding client funds without proper trust accounting can result in losing your license.
Even for unregulated consulting, the reputational risk is enormous. Consultant loses clients' money is not a headline you recover from.
Just hold this money and spend it as needed. It's easier than invoicing. But they're actually asking you to become an unlicensed, unregulated financial intermediary. That's not a simplification. That's a trap.
The refusal was absolutely correct. And the alternative they came up with, issuing a credit card and demanding line item reporting, was its own kind of trap, just less obviously dangerous.
The credit card approach is a trap of 1,000 small cuts, rather than one big one. It won't blow up your business overnight, but it will drain your time, complicate your taxes, and create an ongoing administrative relationship that you're not being paid for. And the fact that the client required reporting down to $5 charges tells you everything about what kind of client they were.
Micromanagement as a service, provided free of charge.
Here's a question for you. What do you think is the most common mistake consultants make on this topic? The thing that seems fine in the moment but causes problems later.
I think it's treating expense handling as a minor operational detail rather than a contractual term. The consultant wants to be easy to work with. The client suggests something casual. Everyone agrees verbally, and nobody writes anything down. Then 6 months later, there's a $5,000 expense the client doesn't remember approving, and there's no paper trail, and now you're in a fight with someone you need to maintain a good relationship with.
The casual agreement. Problem. And it's especially dangerous with expenses because expenses are inherently variable. You don't know at the start of an engagement how much you're going to spend on travel or materials or whatever. So the agreement needs to cover not just how expenses are handled, but what kinds of expenses are authorized, what the approval threshold is, and how quickly the client has to pay.
What happens if they don't pay?
Late payment on reimbursements is a form of involuntary lending. You're effectively financing the client's expenses at 0% interest. If they take 90 days to reimburse you and you've put the expenses on a credit card that charges 20% interest, you're losing money on every transaction.
The expense policy needs teeth, late fees, interest charges, the right to suspend work if reimbursements are more than 30 days overdue. Again, this is standard in larger firms, but sole operators often feel weird about including it.
The weirdness goes away the first time a client is 60 days late on a $4,000 reimbursement and you're looking at your credit card statement.
Let's shift to something more constructive. If you're a sole operator listening to this and realizing your current approach is a mess, what's the first thing you should do?
Audit your current clients. For each one, ask 3 questions. 1. How are expenses currently handled? 2. What's the monthly administrative burden, in hours, of managing those expenses? 3. What's your financial exposure? How much of your money is currently floating client expenses? That audit alone will tell you where the problems are. Then fix the biggest problem first. If you've got one client where you're floating $5,000 and spending 2 hours a month on expense reports, that's your priority. Either convert them to a virtual card, renegotiate the terms, or add a handling fee. Don't try to fix everything at once. Just fix the worst situation.
For new clients, start clean. Engagement letter, expense policy, virtual card is the default. It's much easier to set expectations at the beginning than to change them mid-engagement.
The other thing I'd recommend is separating your business expenses from client expenses. If you use the same credit card for both, you're creating a reconciliation nightmare. Get a dedicated card for client pass-through expenses, or at minimum use a separate tracking system. The goal is that at any moment, you can answer the question, how much money am I owed in reimbursements right now, without spending an afternoon in your accounting software.
If you can't answer that question right now, that's a sign.
That's a big sign.
I want to talk about one more scenario that the prompt didn't explicitly raise, but that follows from the logic. What about expenses that you incur before the engagement is fully signed? The client says, go ahead and book the flight, we'll have the contract sorted by then, and then something falls through.
Never incur expenses without a signed engagement letter. I don't care how urgent it is. I don't care how good the relationship is. Until there's a signed agreement that includes an expense provision, you're spending your own money with no legal obligation on the client's part to reimburse you. If the deal falls through, you eat the cost.
The go ahead and get started trap.
It's not just about reimbursement. If you're incurring expenses on behalf of a client, you need to know what's authorized, what the limits are, and what the approval process is. None of that exists before the engagement letter is signed. so you're flying blind and hoping nothing goes wrong.
Which brings us to the broader principle here. The way you handle expenses is a proxy for how you handle the entire client relationship. If the expense arrangement is casual and undocumented, and you're absorbing all the risk, that's probably true of other aspects of the engagement too.
The expense conversation is a test. A client who says, "Sure, we'll set you up with a virtual card. Here's the spending limit. Let us know if you need anything else," is a client who respects your time and understands that you're running a business. A client who says, "Just put it on your card and we'll figure it out later," or "Here's my credit card, file the expenses weekly," is a client who sees you as an extension of their own operations rather than an independent professional.
There's a class dimension to this that's worth naming. The prompt mentions a high net worth client. There's a particular dynamic where wealthy individuals sometimes treat consultants like household staff. "Here's the card, handle the expenses, I don't want to think about it." And it can feel flattering to be trusted with that level of access, but it's actually a demotion.
The personal assistant dynamic. And it's dangerous precisely because it feels like a close relationship. The client is treating you like an insider, which can feel good, until you realize that insiders don't get engagement letters and liability protections. They get informal arrangements and disputes resolved by power dynamics rather than contracts.
The antidote is professionalism at the boundary. You can be warm and collaborative and still have clear, documented terms. In fact, the clearer the terms, the easier it is to be warm and collaborative because you're not quietly anxious about the unresolved stuff.
The terms don't have to be adversarial. "I want to make sure we have a clean arrangement so neither of us has a tax problem," is a completely reasonable thing to say. Most reasonable clients will appreciate it. The ones who push back are telling you something useful.
Let's try to synthesize this into something actionable. If someone's listening and wants a decision framework they can use tomorrow, what would you give them?
Tier 1, always push for the virtual card. It's the cleanest solution for everyone. Tier 2, if a virtual card isn't possible, use an advance arrangement with a written agreement, separate tracking, and monthly reconciliation. Tier 3, if you must do reimbursement, itemize everything. Invoice monthly, keep all receipts, and build the administrative cost into your rate or add a handling fee. And under no circumstances, accept Model 4, carrying the client's card and doing their expense reporting.
The trust thing, holding client cash, that's not even on the menu.
That's not on the menu. That's the thing you politely decline and then update your assessment of the client who asked.
The other through line here is documentation. Whatever model you're using, write it down. Engagement letter, expense policy, something. The tax authority and the courts do not care about your verbal agreements.
Document as you go. Receipts, approvals, reconciliations. The time to build the paper trail is when the expense happens, not when the client disputes it 6 months later.
There's a phrase that shows up in the prompt. Unjust accounting burden. I keep coming back to it because I think it names something that a lot of solo consultants feel but can't articulate. The burden isn't just the time. It's the injustice of carrying a responsibility that properly belongs to someone else. And the injustice has a cost, not just in hours, but in resentment, in mental overhead, in the slow erosion of the sense that you're running a business rather than working for someone else.
The resentment is a business problem, not just a feelings problem. When you resent a client, the work suffers. You're less creative, less generous, less willing to go the extra mile. You start avoiding their calls. The relationship degrades. And it all started because you said yes to an expense arrangement that you should have said no to.
Saying no at the start is actually better for the relationship in the long run.
Boundaries preserve relationships. It's counterintuitive, but it's true.
One last question. What's the trend here? Are virtual cards becoming more common? Is this problem solving itself over time?
The trend is definitely toward virtual cards and spend management platforms. Companies like Brex and Ramp have made card issuance trivial. It's an API call now. Stripe issuing lets platforms generate virtual cards programmatically. The infrastructure is getting better and cheaper. And the more consultants ask for virtual cards, the more clients will adopt the tools to provide them. We're moving in the right direction. But we're not there yet, and in the meantime, the framework matters.
The advice is, push for the ideal, but have a plan for the reality.
That's the whole thing.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In Tibet, around the year 400, artisans laid a floor using a tiling of equilateral triangles and squares that produced 23 distinct vertex configurations across a single room. If you tried to recreate that floor today using standard ceramic tiles from a home improvement store, you'd need to custom cut approximately 60% of the pieces, because modern manufactured tiles assume no more than 3 shapes in any repeat pattern.
Right.
I have so many questions about who counts vertex configurations.
So, to close this out, the core idea I want to leave with is that expense handling is not a minor operational detail. It's a contractual, financial, and legal boundary that deserves the same attention as your rate and your scope of work. Get it right at the start and it disappears into the background. Get it wrong and it becomes a slow bleed of time, money, and goodwill.
If you take nothing else from this episode, take this. The virtual card is your friend. Ask for it. Make it your default. Your accountant will thank you, your tax return will thank you, and you'll spend less time being an unpaid bookkeeper for someone else's business.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com. And if you got something out of this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen.
We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.